Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm staff writer Megan LaBrice. And thank you, as always, for listening to Fully Booked. We're brought to you today by Dear Evan Hansen, the novel. Capturing the heart and heartbreak of the Tony Award-winning show, this novel is one of the must-read books of the year, and you can pre-order it now, so it will arrive by its pub date, which is October 9th. Our review says, teens will clamor for it, and we think you will too.
Yeah, it's an interesting book. So today, though, we're talking to Gary Steingart about his new novel, Lake Success. It starts with a bang, doesn't it, Megan?
It does. It starts with a bloody bang. It starts with a hedge fund man with $2.4 billion in assets under management, kind of stumbling into, what is it, Port Authority in New York
City? Yes, the bus stop.
Yeah, scratches on his face that from two women in his life, his wife and the nanny of his three-year-old son. And we take it from there.
All the way across the country, actually.
All the way across the country is
where we take it.
This is a challenging book, I would say.
It is, because you're not totally in love with the main character, with Barry, this hedge fund guy. Although he does, I mean, Steingart certainly gives him humanity, and you learn to love him maybe fully, maybe begrudgingly. It's up to you as the reader. But the novel's very funny. It's partly satirical. It's very insightful. It's just got a nice range of tones, you know?
Steingart can write.
He really can. And he's a writer who can turn from humor to poignancy in a really admirable, quick way. So it's just, I guess, if you don't care fully about Barry, you care deeply about Gary Steingart's writing.
Did we mention that the title of this novel is Lake Success?
I think so.
Oh, okay, good.
Which is a spot in Long Island, right?
Yeah, ish.
Ish. Says the New York native.
Yeah, well, we moved up to the country when I was still in elementary school, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, we rarely recommend it, and let's call him up and ask him a few questions.
Let's do it.
So you took Greyhound buses around the country in the summer of 2016. Was that journey the inspiration for this novel, or had you already started writing the novel and the trip was a kind of research for the book?
Yeah, no, I started writing as soon as I got on the Hound. It was June 6th or something, and I think the first page of it was written right after or something like that. It was very much, I kind of wrote a lot of the dialogue down as I went along, in a kind of repertorial fashion. Then I would stick around these horrible motels because the goal was to sort of stay as close to the bus station as possible. And that's not going to give you a lot of great options. But I stayed in a bunch of very scary hotels. And then I would just sit on these scruffy sheets and write down and try to fashion something quickly out of what I had witnessed before on the Hounds.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they call it on the Hound? Do they call it the Hound, or is that?
I've heard of the Hound. Some people call it the Dog. There's a lot of references.
So how many miles logged, how many hours logged in this trip?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's the whole country, right? So it's New York to San Diego, however many miles that is, 2,500, 3,000.
3,000 plus, I would say.
3,000 plus, right? Yeah, I always get it wrong, but it was a lot of miles. And, you know, and I did it in stages. So I did, for example, the New York to Atlanta trip, then I flew home, then I did Atlanta to El Paso, then I flew home, then I did the rest. So there were, you know, it happened in stages because there was no way to, I have a little kid, so I couldn't completely check out for 4 months. And along the way, I stopped in all of these cities and I spent time with friends, new friends. So it was a real kind of journey across America that I'd never undertaken before.
Did you love it?
I did. I mean, look, the Hound is not the most comfortable form of transport, but
right.
Actually, I've taken buses around the world, especially in the former Soviet Union, it's not the worst form of transport. You don't want to sit next to the bathroom, that's for sure.
Pro tip.
Yeah, you do kind of want to, the big thing is making sure your outlets work, because most people just plug into their social media immediately and, you know, and try to disappear from their actual environment.
So you have some friends who are hedge fund managers, I guess. How did the idea come to you to create Barry's character and his profession?
Yeah, so I met a lot of hedge fund guys over about 3 years of research. And they were mostly male. Well, no, they were all male. They were mostly white, with some exceptions. They were, I would say that the people I became friendly with were the more intellectual brand of hedge fund person. Many of them weren't sort of, you know, bros with Wharton educations. They were more PhDs in math or physics who had, you know, were when the sort of quant side of hedge funds began to bloom, they were taken out of academia or they never even started academia. I mean, some of them were in there and realized they could make a lot more money and have these, you know, these lives. But I often wonder if it would have been better for some of them or many of them to have stayed in academia, you know, and made a real difference in their communities instead of just living these very abstract lives, looking at their Bloomberg monitors all day and then playing poker all night with the same people they compete with during the day, you know.
Well, the hedgie at the center of this novel, Lake Success, is Barry Cohen. And he's not a quant. He's more bro-y than a quant, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think he started out, he could have been a quant, but he went so far in the direction of becoming, of studying social cues instead of studying math, you know, that when, by the time he got to Princeton, he just wanted to be, and Princeton is probably the most social school on the planet, you know, and by the time he got there, he just wanted to be one of those guys, and he became one of those guys, but at a cost. And although I have to say that at the end, you know, everyone I met, whether they were bros or quants, everyone lost money in the end anyway. So it wasn't, you know, all those PhDs didn't help that much.
Yeah. And to be fair, Barry does have kind of like a mathematical approach to what he calls his friend moves. You know, he practices, you know,
moves,
potentially what someone might say to him. And then he comes up with like 10 potential responses to that. And then
Right. And when I was a kid, I kind of didn't speak English well. I kind of did something like that, you know, and I was practicing what somebody might say and how I might answer and practicing it in the mirror. And, Barry also, you know, he programs a little computer, like I think it was a Commodore or something when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there was a kind of, I did the same when I was a kid, and there was a kind of if-then sort of thing, you know, if X happens, then the computer code jumps to Y. And I think Barry does that kind of stuff too.
So at the beginning of the story, we're introduced to him, and he is bleeding from his face. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about why?
Yeah. Well, he is. He's been gouged by his nanny, his kid's nanny, and his wife. They've attacked him. They've gouged him. He's and the reason they attacked him is because he tried to grab his autistic son and tried to get him to speak. His son is nonverbal, but in a very drunken fit after a very long night of very heavy drinking, Barry kind of explodes and tries to get his son to talk, which of course isn't going to happen. And his wife and nanny appropriately defend the kid and gouge him. And so there's some bleeding happening. So, you know, and that's kind of Barry. I mean, he's a schmuck in many ways, you know, who grabs their autistic kid, but there's a kind of, he also desperately wants to connect with his kid as well. I mean, he wants a child that he can communicate with because his father never communicated with him very much. He was a very absent father. So, you know, I think there's he's trying to, in his own very stupid and ineffective way, he's trying to break a cycle of parenting. But if there was one dad that wasn't meant for a kid with special needs, it was Barry Cohen.
So the sections of this novel that feature Shiva, their artistic child. You know, I mean, they're so insightful, but I would say, I mean, they're not so much about autism, but about its effect on the families of, you know, autistic mm-hmm. people. How did you get interested in that?
Yeah, I've always been very interested in autism, and I've always felt a kind of strange kinship with people who are on the spectrum. And funny enough, you know, many of the hedge fund people I met would talk about other people and say, oh, well, he's definitely on the spectrum. And although I'm not capable of diagnosing, there were some, you know, that would not have been a huge surprise. Mm-hmm. But we're talking more about what used to be Asperger's. Now it's been rolled into the spectrum diagnosis. But, you know, I've always felt, again, as I said, I grew up not understanding social cues, partly because I couldn't speak the language, but there was a real, the idea of, I mean, I hate things like small talk and all the social niceties that people have to undergo. I mean, I feel like, oh, make it stop. I'd rather be home in a quiet room and not dealing with any of this stuff, you know. So, and people that have been wonderful and so individual, you know, people think it's just everyone's the same on the spectrum and has these very stereotypical traits. But, you know, I hung out with Temple Grandin, which was the highlight of my life, basically. And she's amazing. You know, we had lunch and a couple of drinks, and she was just this wonderful, wild, smart, witty person and who can communicate in a different way, but in a better way than most of the people I know.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, there's this nice phrase in here, the grand fallacy of 21st century America. And the reason you write that is because there's a point when Barry's wife, Seema, at first thinks that Barry can't be stupid because he's so wealthy, but later she kind of questions that idea, wondering if it's, quote, you know, the grand fallacy of 21st century America to think that wealthy people are smart.
Yeah. No, that's it. I mean, that's the point I was trying to make. And as I was making it, of course, Donald Trump's candidacy was on the rise. And that is the great American fallacy, is that people who are poor must be somehow morally inadequate. You know, it's not just poverty. It's a kind of stain on their soul or something. Whereas people who are rich must be, by definition, must be blessed by God and should be able to lead us in any way they can, you know. And this doesn't just apply to the presidency. I mean, a lot of the hedge fund people I met were involved in policies that they should never have been involved with. For example, obsessed with education policy. Barry, of course, wants to start the Urban Watch Fund, the fund to help young urban children buy their first Rolex and learn to take care of it, which is really a dumb idea. But some of the stuff I heard from these other people were equally as dumb, but they were actually being implemented, you know. And the idea is, well, I've made a few good trades, or actually I haven't made a few good trades. Some of the people I know, their lives have been about losing money for their investors while making money for themselves. But we think, wow, he's made so much money. Let's hand him, you know, he should run every aspect of our society. These are the real geniuses, you know. But it is just not true. And I think the current occupant of the White House proves it, and just hopefully will. After him, there will be no business people in the White House for a while.
Mm. And so do you think that, I mean, Trump, I think if you look at the real record, like, he, you know, he's not that great of a businessman, but
he's
certainly
businessman.
Yeah. And he's,
in fact,
he's certainly.
Many of the hedgies I met said, you know, he asked us for money and we'd never give it to him because he's a loser.
Yeah. But he certainly sold himself as that. Do you think that the people who voted for him just bought that lock, stock, and barrel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, there was a person on the Greyhound who was, nobody wanted to sit next to him because people thought he had some mental difficulties and he was also very overweight. And he sat next to me and he started talking to me and I don't know how we got onto Trump, but he said, yeah, I'm going to vote for him because he's a billionaire and because he's only going to surround himself with the brightest people. And people really bought into that idea. You know, he used the B word, billionaire, although since we don't have access to his tax returns, we have no idea whether that's true or not. But, you know, that was all it took for a lot of people. He was the billionaire who catered to undereducated voters, and that was it. That was the good stuff. Well, plus the racism, of course.
The whole thing makes my face hot.
Yeah. So, you know, so there's a difficulty to writing a book in the age of Trump that has to deal somewhat with politics because, you know, I mean, look, I know readers are exhausted from this stuff. Trump invades every aspect of our living lives. And But so, so my editor said, can we just use the T word 6 times throughout the book? And I said, maybe 18, and we kind of got it down to 12 or something. And but, I hear you. So I hear the readers. So I want to make sure that the book is primarily about a family, but set against the backdrop of this election.
Yeah, it's interesting. Are we actually currently living in the year that was the setting for Super Sad True Love Story?
Sort of. I mean, that's the when I wrote that, I mean, it was published, I wrote it around 2008, that was the sort of, and then it was published in 2010. But my idea was that would happen, I don't know, 20, 30 years from now, this kind of neo-fascist social media controlled universe. But it took 6 years for it to happen. and I think that's it just goes to show you how super accelerated everything is these days, that we're in this timeline that's just collapsing onto itself.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then this book is going back, of course, we're going to 2016. No wonder you wear a watch.
Historical fiction.
Yeah. you need multiple watches.
There's a competent
watches.
Man in the White House. Yeah. It's crazy.
It is.
I want to ask you about Barry's philanthropic ideas, because there's a chance for us to see some of Barry's humanity in the sections of the novel where his philanthropic ideas come to light, and you mentioned his watch fund idea, but all of his philanthropic ideas and really efforts, I mean, he spends 9 months, I think, in Rwanda, are terrible. Why is he so terrible at that?
Why is he so bad at that?
Yeah.
Oh, because I think, like many of the hedge fund people I've met, that Barry leads this completely moated existence where he's in his beautiful apartment and he's at his funds, and he doesn't really notice the rest of the planet. And he grew up, like many people I met, he grew up lower middle class. But it's very easy to distance yourself and to think that you're part of this anointed crowd that knows and understands everything from the perch of your, 10,000 square foot apartment. And so Barry always brings that kind of bluster and naivete as well to everything, Oh, I'm going to help this drug dealer by helping him buy a real watch. I'm going to, I'm going to go to Rwanda and to a society that's so complex and about which I know nothing, but I'm going to make it right, because I'm going to make peace between the Hutus and the Tutsi. It's like everything's. It's like I got the magic touch, and I'm going to do it.
Yeah. You must have seen Anand Giri Haradas' new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World.
Yeah, no, I've heard of it. I have not read it, but I've heard of it. And from what I've read about it, it sounds absolutely true, And also there's this idea of, we're doing such good work. The way the tax regime works, and especially under Trump, essentially this is just a giant transfer of wealth from everyone to a tiny, tiny group of people. And then they take a tiny portion of that or some portion of that and do philanthropic acts and then wildly publicize those to say, look, we are the kindest people ever. We're not even going to keep all our money, not to mention the tax breaks that they get for doing this philanthropy. So, it's a complete charade as per the title of that book. It's all just nonsense, and it's all about naming rights and essentially you just want to show off your wealth. This is like because after a while you've done, there's only so much you can own, there's only so many houses you can have in every part of the world, and then it's about getting your name on a hospital or something like that. And believe me, that's not being altruistic, that's just wanting to say I won the biggest contest of them all, because all the money they earn after a certain amount is just a score sheet to be kept against one another, the same way they keep a score sheet of poker.
Mm-hmm. So should we have a limit after a certain amount? You got to stop.
Well, these tax rates are unbelievable. We've never, even 30 years ago, even under Reagan, the tax rates were, far higher than they are today. We've done everything we can to enable this transfer of money. And what it creates is these very schmucky characters like Barry. Mm-hmm. In any other society before this, Barry would not have been the person he would have been. I mean, the goal for many people back in the day, smart, educated people, were becoming the ophthalmologist of your town, becoming the chief lawyer of your town. Some, things where you stayed in the community, you did whether you helped out in one way or another, you interacted with people. The best people I met on The Hound were people like professors of the University of Texas at El Paso who actually worked with kids, first generation college kids from El Paso, from across the border in Mexico. I mean, these were much happier people. They weren't poor. They lived quite well because it's not that expensive to live in the EPT. But, you know, they saw every day the way they were bringing a benefit to the world, as opposed to people who sit around at a Bloomberg terminal shifting around numbers, trying to make up for the fact that their mother never loved them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Barry is so very much a tourist in this. I mean, back to that first page where he's still bleeding out of his face, he imagines, yeah. You know, like a big boned woman will come feed him soul food, yeah. And they'll call each other by their first names because they're part of the human race, man.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah. That's the dream, that he can sort of walk his way into humanity, despite the fact that he's been shirking his for so long.
Right. And also, like, in addition to the competition, what spurs him on early on in this book is, like, this very personal hurt. You know, his wife, Seema, at a small dinner party, has a comment that he kind of lacks imagination and perhaps even a soul. And that's, like, something he really carries with him, like a hot coal. Like, I'll show you. I've got both an imagination and a soul. Voila, Urban Watch Fund.
Yeah. Yeah, because he still thinks of himself. I mean, so this journey, he thinks, okay, everything's gone wrong in my life. What's the last time I was really happy? And he thinks back to his college days when he was a writing minor or major, I can't remember. And he wanted to write, and he wanted to follow his heroes, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and all those dudes from the from the first half of the 20th century. And he tries so hard to spark this idea of himself as a creative being, even though that's been underwater for so long. And I think a lot of the people I've met, because they're so unhappy, because they're making all this money, the money never adds up to anything. They were eager to talk to me because I represented a kind of different world, a world where everything wasn't quantified. I mean, you know, writers don't make the kind of money that hedge fund people obviously do, or any kind of bankers do. But at the same time, it seemed like I was living, a full emotional and creative life. And I think that was, to their credit, they wanted to know, they asked me questions. They wanted to know what it was like, what it was like to go out into the world, to participate in the world. And that was something new to them.
You know, this section of the novel that is about El Paso and about the students at the University of Texas at El Paso, I mean, you've got this great paragraph where a professor there, a love interest of Barry's, someone from his past, is saying that, you know, the students there are happier than the students at Princeton. Did you get a chance to go to the university there? And is that observation from...
Mm-hmm. I was a kind of visiting guest for a little bit, and I hung out with them. Mm-hmm. They were amazing, amazing kids. But I also taught at Princeton for a little bit and recall quite well. I mean, some of the, Barry writes the story. Everyone in Barry's class writes the story about how he's going to become a banker and he's going to hate his life. And there were actually kids who wrote those kinds of stories. You know, they could already project the fact that they were going to go into Goldman and be miserable. But there was no other way. I mean, you know, you were at Princeton, you go into finance, there was almost no other way out. And they just followed that path, knowing full well what they were getting into. Whereas the kids in El Paso, their path was that they were, for the most part, not all of them, but many were going to be the first in their family to become college graduates and to have white collar jobs, hopefully. And there was an excitement there. And it was a professor's excitement, too. The people that teach there were just so... You could see the world become something different in their hands, and they looked forward to their classes. They wanted to teach, I taught at Hunter College in the city, the city of New York for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that was also incredibly inspiring.
Yeah. I do. You have to tell me if I'm accurate about this or not, but I do love your homage, if that's the right word, to Edmund White in this novel.
I don't want to, create one character, but... Yeah, there are certainly professors who have taught at Princeton who, they love their kids, because the thing about Princeton is that they're so smart, obviously. And for the most part, they're not like jaded kids that you get at some colleges. There's a kind of rah-rah spirit. But in aggregate, it's a school that I have very mixed feelings about. And I wrote a piece, a nonfiction piece, about a hedge fund guy for the New Yorker, who was also a Princeton graduate, and the beginning of the piece starts at the Princeton reunion. And, you know, they're not bad people, but somehow the collusion between Princeton and finance creates for a bit of a toxic stew that I think people know about it and still go into it. I mean, my dream is somebody reads this book and they're in finance and the book helps them leave finance. If one person does that, it would have been worth the price of admission.
You heard it here, everybody.
It would have been worth all those years on the hound. All those months on the hound.
Yeah. You
went
Some
to Oberlin,
want the
right?
Nobel Prize, but...
Yeah. But you yeah. just want to... It's yeah. noble.
No,
it's
I just good. Want to get one person off the streets.
At the beginning, you mentioned, you know, some hedge fund people that you made friends with. But your assessment in the novel of their livelihood is, you know, quite honest and kind of unblinking. Do you still have hedge fund friends?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think some of them think that, I mean, some of them, have, you know, a lot of them have read it. And I think almost everyone has said this is an accurate portrayal. Also, at a recent reading, somebody from the SEC came and said that was an accurate portrayal, not just of hedge fund people, but of the process of, you know, Barry is being pursued by the SEC. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's accurate enough that, I mean, I think maybe many of these people will say, well, that's not me. You know, that's, mm-hmm. and yeah, there is no one person that became Barry, obviously, but I think many people also are honest about the fact that they're not happy or at least are looking for a way out. And that's the thing with Barry, you know, he would be completely intolerable, I think, if he wasn't looking for something, but he is. And I'm not, you know, I don't want to tell potential readers whether the search is successful or not, but I think it's the search that makes him human, not anything that happens when he was, while he was at the office.
No, I feel like we've talked a lot about Barry and potentially like we've given short shrift to Seema, his wife, mm-hmm. because she does get sure. her own alternating chapters. I was wondering if we could talk a little yep. bit about her and what's happening at the beginning of the book.
Sure. And I'll say, you know, that Seema is somebody who I would often meet the wives of hedge fund managers, and they were often much smarter, much more credentialed, so to speak, than their husbands. But now they were, you know, forced into a kind of very feudal role where they were basically curators of their family's lives, shepherding their four kids into, you know, into the Ivy League. And Seema falls into that trap. You know, she's a Yale law graduate. She's super bright. And as the book goes on, she finds herself increasingly trapped in this kind of very feudal role. And, you know, and to give Seema some credit, she does, raising a child with severe special needs is, of course, much more difficult and often requires full-time work. But, you know, there is, I think, there's a lot of longing in her part, which she translates into this very misguided affair with this kind of loser writer who lives in her building. And you know, and so...
He's a writer's writer. Why.
He's a writer's writer, as he says, meaning nobody reads him. So, you know, so the book is not just making fun of hedge funds. It's also sort of making fun of the entire landscape of New York, including the media and creative landscape. So when it comes to satire, there's a lot of fun stuff to go around.
I was wondering, do you see satirization as an act of love?
It's very kind of you to say. I'll go with that.
Sure. Okay.
If you want to believe that, that's fine. No, I think satirization is, in many ways, a kind of a way to let off steam. Mm-hmm. Because we are living in an increasingly problematic society. And, I mean, there's wonderful sort of polemic screeds that one can read about that, but I'd rather sneak it in through the guise of humor. Mm.
Well, thanks for your time, Gary. The novel is Lake Success. It's out now, and we loved reading it.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I actually couldn't stop reading it. It was, yeah. I was really conflicted about it, too, because I'm like, this guy is a schmuck.
But, I know. Balancing act. Yeah. great.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so
thanks
much.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you guys.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked. This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So Megan, you're right. Barry Cohen, the protagonist of this novel, is a big schmuck.
Yeah, and not to be confused, Clay, with a schlemiel, which is a lot more hapless. He is a verifiable...
Or a schnorter.
Oh. He's a schmuck.
Barry's father in the novel accuses him of being a schnorter. So, but yeah, I mean, I love the way that the novel starts sort of dramatically with this very wealthy guy at the Port Authority taking a greyhound with... blood oozing out of his face.
Yeah, it's true. I didn't just say this because Gary was on the line. I could not stop reading it because it was a very funny, complicated experience for me. You know, I really didn't want to like this character, but yet I really wanted to find out what was going to happen to him.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, almost like a, you know, what awful thing is going to happen to him next? You know, just sort of the drama of that. So
I do have a favorite moment that I won't disclose, but he does hit what I consider to be his rock bottom.
Yeah.
That was particularly delightful to witness.
And jarring, because I think we're probably maybe thinking about the same thing.
You might be a better person than I am.
Yeah. Well, we've got some news for the Fully Booked listeners. This is the first week that we can talk about the 2018 Kirkus Prize finalist. Every year, Kirkus Reviews gives away $150,000 to three writers, so $50,000 for each. And the categories are fiction, nonfiction, and young readers literature. And today, we are announcing all 18 finalists. There are six finalists in each category. And today, we'll talk about the other categories in future episodes, but today, we want to talk to you about the nonfiction. Yeah.
This is exciting.
So tell us about a few of them, Megan.
Well, I mean, you know I have to start with Dope Sick by Beth Macy. And I believe that she definitely is the first person to be nominated twice for the Kirkus Prize, right?
There might be one other, but it's very rare. Let's put it that way.
Well, it's very rare. Either way, mazel tov to Beth Macy, one of my favorite investigative journalists. She's based in Virginia, and Dope Sick is her exploration of the opioid epidemic. And it is just tremendous. And I'm very happy to see that she's been honored by the judges this year.
Yeah. We've also, I mean, we're you know, this year nonfiction is a lot of questioning about the sort of state that America's in. And so we've got the judges in nonfiction shows, American Prison by Shane Bauer. And people may remember this investigative article he wrote for Mother Jones about being hired as a security guard at a privately run for-profit prison. And that article got a ton of attention and prompted him to write this longer book. And so it's about his experience at a for-profit prison in Louisiana. And it's striking and depressing, but a really necessary, fascinating read.
Then we've also got Call Them by Their True Names, American Crises and Essays by Rebecca Solnit. For those who are not familiar with her work, she's the author of Men Explain Things to Me. She's a prolific essayist. And this is kind of like her... You know, this offers context and support for, you know, our current Trumpian moment, you know, but I don't think overwhelmingly it's a very optimistic portrait that emerges, but she's a very thoughtful, exciting essayist, and kudos to her for making the list.
Yeah. It's also a big year for political nonfiction. People may remember Timothy Snyder because his book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, was a bestseller for, I mean, like week after week. And his new one is called The Road to Unfreedom. And it's talking about Russia, Europe, and the United States, and how we may or may not be sort of sliding toward fascism in those countries. So, you know, another really insightful book from him. And then we've got Heartland by Sarah Smarsh. Yeah, she is a Kansas native who I think still lives there. And she grew up working class, and she's really writing about the class divide and how it's affected her and about her upbringing and also about policy. You know, interesting book that mixes policy talk with a really personal story. So it's really affecting and it's getting great reviews.
Oh, and it's super buzzy in the industry. Like all of the book people whose opinions I very much respect love this book. Its subtitle is A Daughter of the Working Class Reconciles an American Divide. So super buzzy book from Smarsh, a fellow at Harvard Kennedy School for Government. Yeah. Of government, I believe. I want to mind my prepositions. School of Government.
That's right. And the judges chose another book from that same publisher, which is Scribner, Heavy, by Kesey Lehman. And the subtitle of that one is An American Memoir. And that book is about the author growing up in Mississippi and very much about race. A thin book, but man, it packs a lot in there. So a lot of great reads among those six finalists.
And I noticed in describing them that we mentioned the judges a few times, but we didn't mention who the judges are. And they are Joseph Barbato. He's an author and journalist. Karina Chicano, whose You Play the Girl essay collection came out, was it last year? And it won the National Book Critics Circle Award for criticism. She's great.
Right.
And then also bookseller Cheryl Kotler. So those are our judges for nonfiction.
Yeah. And we want to thank them for doing a lot of reading. Books that are nonfiction books that have been starred in the past year are eligible for the Kirkus Prize for Nonfiction and all
that's
the Kirkus
a lot
prizes,
of books, so. Believe me.
It is a lot of books. And our editors have been kindly and thoughtfully guiding the judges. And let's get them on the phone now because we want to ask them which new bestsellers they think are worth your time.
Let's do it. We're joined now by our editors for their top picks in books this week. We have children's editor Vicki Smith, YA editor Laura Simeon, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Vicki, what you got for us?
I've got an absolutely stunning back-to-school book called The Day You Begin by Jacqueline Woodson with illustrations by Rafael Lopez.
Awesome.
And yeah, it really is. It's as emotionally intelligent as anything that Jacqueline Woodson does. But what it does, it looks at four different children who all are starting school and feeling for one reason or another just acutely different from everybody in their class. And you know, one little girl feels physically different, and she's also the only kid who, seemingly the only kid who stayed home all summer babysitting while everybody else went to glamorous places. Another little boy has just moved here from Venezuela, and he speaks with an accent, and the other children laugh at him. Another little girl is mocked for the lunch that she brings. It's a lunch of kimchi, and she thinks to herself, actually, the text is in the second person. So it says, you'll wonder why she, and that's talking about her friend, doesn't remember that rice is the most popular food in the world. So, you know, nobody can get in a burn as gently as Jacqueline Woodson can. And then the fourth child is a little white boy who's in a different setting. The brilliant thing about this book is that the first three children, the little brown-skinned girl who doesn't go away for the summer, and the little Venezuelan boy and little Korean girl, they find support among one another. There's a fourth character, a little white boy in a different school, who is by himself and is able to find strength in himself to conquer these sort of feelings of apartness and insufficiency. So it's as gentle as anything Jacqueline Woodson does, and so empathetic to all the different situations that kids, you know, get into where they just feel out of place, and lets them know that even if they feel out of place today, they won't always be feeling out of place.
And Vicki, you know, what I loved about the book, apart from, everything you said and the gorgeous illustrations is I think sometimes adults think that if you just don't talk about differences, the kids won't notice them and everyone will get along and be just fine. And of course, you know, kids notice who's different and sometimes they don't know what to do with that information. So I feel like the book also speaks to all the other kids and saying, hey, you know, here are some ways that you can proactively reach out and make someone feel welcome. It's kind of a map to being a good friend and good classmate. So
yeah, in 32 pages, it's a very hardworking, beautiful little book.
Yes.
Well, also, for those who are not subscribers, we've got Jacqueline Woodson on the cover of the current issue. It's the Legends issue. It's a beautiful photograph. I loved how the cover turned out.
Yeah, and that turned out really nicely. So, Laura, what are we liking in young adult?
So I'm really excited about this new fantasy novel by Alex London, which got a Kirkus star just out. It's called Black Wings Beating, and it's set in this sort of alternate Central Asian world where, you know, birds of prey are the center of life, and the most elusive and deadly one of all is the ghost eagle. And the main characters are twins, Kylie and Bryson, and their father, who was just a nasty, horrible, kind of abusive, drunken, gambling, kind of not a lot going for him. But he went out hunting the ghost eagle and was killed by one, which most people who try to capture the ghost eagle are. But he left behind all these debts. So now Kylie and Bryson and their mother, they're kind of, you know, trying to work really hard, repay the father's debts. Meanwhile, Bryson, he has a boyfriend named Demian who also has these debts, and he's promised these moneylenders that he will capture a ghost eagle, and, you know, which again is a very almost impossible thing to do. And Kylie has this tremendous gift, the talent for communicating with the birds of prey. And so it's this adventure where they are going out to try to basically capture a ghost eagle and rescue Demian. And then meanwhile, there's this extremist religious group who does not believe that anyone should be doing anything with the birds. The setting is vivid. The pacing is excellent. It's just a wonderful fantasy, very immersive.
Laura, it sounds so good. I had never heard of Alex London before, but I wasn't even sure if Alex London was male or female. Being me, I assumed it was a woman, but it turns out that he's a man. But, you know, I wondered if you knew anything about his earlier books that you could tell me.
Yeah, he's written almost everything except adult fiction, which is probably why you haven't come across him. But he writes also as C. Alexander London. And so he used to be a journalist. He also has an MLS, so he's a qualified librarian, which I like. But he was a journalist in conflict zones and so on. So he's written a couple of adult nonfiction books, and then picture books, middle grade, sort of funny adventure stories. His young adult science fiction series Proxy is popular, but the accidental adventure middle grade series is great. They're really funny ones. The first one is We Are Not Eaten by Yaks, which is also about twins. So anyway, yeah, that was very popular at my old school library. So.
Turning now to recommendations in fiction. Lori, what's your choice?
I would like to recommend a book called Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, a new entry to the bestseller list. It's a really immersive read, the kind of book that you just kind of get swept up into. Yeah. It's it takes place on the coast of North Carolina. So considering that that's an area that's in everybody's minds at the moment, it's
right.
Very timely for it, I guess. The heroine of the book is a woman starting out as a little girl named Kaya Clark, who lives with her family in sort of the swamp area outside of town in North Carolina. And as the book is opening, Kaya is, I don't know, 5 or 6 or maybe even younger than that. And her mother is leaving. Her mother just can't take it anymore. Her mother comes from a sort of slightly elevated background and is tired of living in the swamp and is tired of her abusive husband. So she leaves. And the Kaya is there along with some older siblings. And over a short period of time, all the other siblings leave as well, leaving this little girl alone with her sort of neglectful, abusive father, who eventually disappears himself. And from by the time she's about 6 years old, she's virtually alone in this swamp, and she learns everything that she needs to know about survival, which has to do a lot with, you know, learning about the tides and taking a boat out and learning all about the swamp. This is her first novel. Her earlier books were nonfiction memoirs about her time living in Africa, studying endangered species. And she's really wonderful on nature writing and, you know, imparting a lot of information while telling a great story. And then, you know, all kinds of things happen. The book is bracketed by a murder trial. Young man has died in the swamp, and Kaya is the suspect. And so, you know, it's framed by that, and you wonder, how did this little girl get to that point? And there's romance with two different men. And as the book goes on, it becomes a little bit more conventional than it started out as. But it's a very, interesting and intriguing book.
Cool. I'm going to put it in my pile.
Yeah. I was really interested in this book, Lori, more as a publishing phenomenon than as a story, because, you know, I was looking at the author's prior books, thinking, what about this author and, you know, her track record has caused this book to hit the bestseller list? And I did a little digging and saw that it is the current Reese Witherspoon Hello Sunshine Book Club pick. Which explained everything to me, and that caused me to just sort of reflect on the power of the celebrity book endorsement to drive sales. And many people outside of librarianship may not remember September 17th, 1996. But I remember it very clearly because it was a perfectly ordinary day. And then all of a sudden in mid-morning, there was this throng of people all coming in to get Jacqueline Mitchard's The Deep End of the Ocean. And we'd had no idea because, of course, we were working and not watching TV, but it was the very, very first Oprah book club pick. And everybody was caught unawares. You know, so the first person who got into the library got our single book, and everybody else had to wait. And it was this, it created, you know, that moment really changed a lot of the way that publicity and sort of communication and these sort of pre-sale ramp up campaigns operate, because, you know, every librarian in the country said, come on, Oprah, can you tell us, give us some advance notice next time? Right. And it changed everything. I asked some librarian friends if the Reese Witherspoon Club has as much of an impact as the Oprah Club. And apparently the systems are in place, and it's not the shock is not as great as it used to be. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's still, you know, it's on the bestseller list, and there are 13 copies in my library system with 51 holds on it of this book. So,
wow.
That's the power of the celebrity.
I love your reporting, Vicky. I know. You're good, man.
Yeah. That's amazing. But it's funny, when I saw it on the bestseller list, I also wondered, I read this book a couple months ago, and I thought, why is that book on the bestseller list? But that, it just ended there. But Vicky, you did the work. That is really interesting.
Well, the fact that I remember that Oprah's first book club pick was The Deep End of the Ocean says something about how traumatic that day was.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody. And thanks for your reporting, Vicky. So next week, we're going to talk to Lisa Unger. You have probably heard of her. She is a major thriller writer. And her new one, Under My Skin, has a star from us. And our reviewer calls it a standout thriller. So we hope you will join us for that episode next week. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.